Bagan, Quandt writes, had once again put his reputation for rigidity and verbal precision to good use for major political purposes. In the end, it was this combination of single-mindedness, tenacity, and toughness, coupled with a real understanding of the uses of power and persuasion, that made of Menachem Bagan a larger-than-life-size figure. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 275, Carter in Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. One of the most famous principles of Zev Jabotinsky and of Beitar is the embrace of what he called hadar, a word in Hebrew that, as many note, is difficult to define, but which above all refers to dignity, the principle that a Jew ought to present oneself to the world in a way that reflects pride in our people, in our heritage, in our history. Menachem Bagan embodied this principle of hadar like few others. He was, again, as many note, the first prime minister to insist on wearing a suit and tie everywhere, believing that as a leader in Israel, his people deserved the respect that he accorded them. But the clothing that Bagan wore was an external expression of a larger notion of dignity and of pride in the best sense, a dignified, justified pride in Jewish history in the face of those that did not accord the appropriate respect due to Israel as a sovereign state, a state that was faced with decisions about its security and well-being unlike most countries on earth. Without question, this embrace of hadar was learned from Jabotinsky, but it was also learned by Bagan from his father, who taught him when Bagan was growing up to respond to anti-Semitism without fear and to stand up with pride for one's people. We have seen how Bagan embodied hadar, a dignified pride, as he stood for the Jewish right to Jerusalem during the Camp David negotiations. And we will see hadar personified as we study the way Menachem Bagan carried himself during an important presidential visit to the Holy Land. After the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize, the negotiations between Egypt and Israel got bogged down in various areas over subjects ably summarized by Avi Shilon. Sadat had demanded that a special office be set up in Gaza by Egypt to advance the autonomy plan, and this demand for an office was rejected by Bagan. Another debate concerned the intended normalization between Egypt and Israel, with Bagan asking for a full and total normalization as soon as the withdrawal from the Sinai began, and Sadat seeking a slower normalization process. Bagan's attitude, of course, reflected the principles at the heart of his criticism of the Rogers Plan, a criticism that was so often misunderstood. Bagan, during the debate over the Rogers Plan, had demanded the promise of full peace as an exchange for sacrifices made by Israel. Here, some years later, Bagan was asking that full peace be established as soon as Israel's sacrifices had begun to be made. With so much on the line during the negotiations, Carter traveled to Israel in an attempt to move the discussions along, emphasizing his own presidential power as he met with Bagan and members of the Israeli cabinet, including Yosef Burg and Shmuel Tamir. Avi Shilon draws on Bagan's experience in Poland and Bagan's memories of Jewish history in Poland in giving us his own interpretation of what occurred. Here is Shilon's description. Quote, in March 1979, Carter came to the Middle East for a visit dubbed as crucial because both sides were worn out from the peace process and negotiations had reached an impasse. During his visit to Israel, he was invited to take part in the weekly cabinet meeting, at which he thought he noted a hint of rebuke from several ministers who voiced their opposition to positions he had expressed during the talks. In a fit of pique, he let slip something along the lines of, "You will do whatever the United States tells you to." The embarrassed ministers fell silent and looked at Bagan, who was incensed by Carter's outburst. Once again, he was the proud Jew facing up to the oppressive Polish feudal lord. "We are a sovereign country," he said defiantly. "No one will tell us what to do, and I shall not sign any document that this government does not approve." Stung by the apparent scolding, Carter stood up to leave, but Burg and Tamir prevailed upon him to stay. The incident proved to be important, however, because Carter understood at this point that Bagan was in political trouble domestically and could not make any further concessions. On arriving in Egypt, he persuaded Sadat to drop his demand for a liaison office in Gaza because Bagan saw it as an infringement on Israel's sovereignty. Agreement was also reached over the supply of Egyptian oil to Israel. End quote. So Shilon writes, his story is a fascinating one because it reflects, to my mind, how Bagan's hadar was not only an objective value that he embraced, though of course it was that, but it also lay at the heart of Bagan's strength as a negotiator. By holding firm and defending the honor of his democratically elected government, at a moment when Bagan was being pressured, Bagan was able to achieve the peace he so desperately sought without sacrificing on issues that were so important to him. Begin was, as at least one American member of Carter's team would later reflect, a master negotiator who knew how to seize on tension connected to the limitations of time in order to achieve what he was seeking. We have noted how many describe Begin as inflexible. This, as I have further discussed, is unfair. But knowing that many saw him this way, Begin was not averse of using this reputation that was unfairly applied to him in order to gain a better hand for Israel during negotiation. Here is a passage from an article by Carter's National Security Staff member, William Quant, describing the very same Carter visit to Israel. Quant's article, interestingly, was written at the lowest moment of Begin's career in 1983, right after Begin retired, when he essentially disappeared from the public eye for much of the rest of his life. At this point in 1983, it might have been very tempting for those that had faced off against Begin to write an article besmirching Begin's skills. But no, it was at this moment that Quant wrote a tribute to Begin's skills of statecraft, in which Quant reflected on the brilliance that Begin showed in negotiation, a brilliance that Quant thought would be remembered, a brilliance that would be part of Begin's legacy. Quant writes, quote, "In March 1979, in one of his most remarkable performances, Begin once again took negotiations to the brink of failure before edging back just enough to ensure success on his terms. President Carter decided to travel to the Middle East in a last attempt to clinch an agreement between Sadat and Begin. By the time he arrived in Jerusalem, only a few significant issues remained to be solved. One involved a footnote to one article of the treaty. The Egyptians wanted a phrase changed from "does not derogate from" to "does not contradict." Begin maintained that this change would nullify the entire sense of the treaty, an implication that none of the native English speakers could see in the proposed revision. Much of one day was spent in Jerusalem with the American and Israeli delegations looking through dictionaries and thesauruses to find substitute language," end quote. As Quant goes on to describe in his article, Begin was thus witness to Carter and Cyrus Vance, along with others, engaging in research regarding a specific English phrase. Quant then continues, quote, "Finally, Begin came into the room and announced that he had found a solution. He proposed the phrase, does not affect, which had exactly the opposite meaning from that which was intended. Secretary Vance replied that does not contravene seemed more appropriate. Begin hesitated, gravely acknowledged that this was a serious proposal, and said that he would have to discuss it with his cabinet. A few hours later, the answer came back. Begin could not accept does not contravene, but he could accept is not to be construed as contravening. The Americans, who never quite understood the game that was being played, saw no difference, shrugged, and felt relieved to have gotten over one more hurdle. Of course," Quant continues, "the other important issues that could have been discussed during those long hours were all still pending, to be dealt with in haste on the morning of Carter's departure from Israel. Begin," Quant writes, "had once again put his reputation for rigidity and verbal precision to good use for major political purposes. In the end, it was this combination of single-mindedness, tenacity, and toughness, coupled with a real understanding of the uses of power and persuasion, that made of Menachem Begin a larger-than-life-size figure," end quote. A date in the end of March was set for the signing of the Accords at the White House. As we will see, Hadar would be central to Begin's presentation there. But that Hadar would not be pride in the face of scorn or pressure or discrimination, but pride reflected in a description of his people's history and his family's history, of Jewish yearnings and Jewish loves, of the story of Jewish endurance, and in a description of the fundamentals of the Jewish faith. There in Washington, D.C., in the White House, before the eyes of the world, Menachem Begin would pay tribute to the past in a way that would be remembered by so many to this day. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.